Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Joe Estlack and Marilee Talkington about the world premiere of Little Eric at the Aurora Theater. Also, a conversation with conductor Edwin Outwater, who leads an eclectic program at the San Francisco Symphony this week, including a concert that starts about an hour from now in Davies Symphony Hall, with guest pianist Stephen Hoff part of the mix. We'll also hear from the actors in Hillbarn Theater's upcoming production of the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, which opens already here in the Bay Area at the Hillbarn Theater. Stay with us. The Aurora Theater Company continues its 24th season with the world premiere of Little Eric. Written and directed by award-winning Bay Area auteur Mark Jackson, Little Eric features Marilee Talkington and Joe Estlack, as well as Wilma Bonet, Greg Ayers, and Mariah Castle. It's a contemporary adaptation of Henrik Ibsen's Little Eyolf, and it opens tomorrow, running through February 28th at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Two of those cast members join me in studio to talk about the production. Marilee Talkington, who appeared in the company's productions of Rapture, Blister, Burn, and the world premiere of the aforementioned Mark Jackson's Salomania, returns as Joy in Little Eric. Her credits include productions at Berkeley Rep, Crowded Theater, and Magic Theater, among others, including several off-Broadway productions. She's also the founder of Vanguardian Productions. Welcome to you, Marilee.
Howdy. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Of course. And joining her once again in our studios, or at least new to this studio, is Joe Estlack as Freddy in Little Eric. He previously appeared in Aurora's Bay Area premiere of The Lions. Additional credits also include productions at Shotgun, Magic Theater, San Francisco Playhouse, San Jose Stage, and Mugwumpin, which I think he was last on to talk about. Welcome back to you, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Playwright and director Mark Jackson has used Henrik Ibsen's play as the inspiration for this play. Were either of you familiar with Henrik Ibsen's Little Eyolf before this production?
I was not, actually. Were you, Joe?
No, I wasn't familiar, and I read it when I first got notice of coming to the audition.
Likewise.
Okay, so who is the title character? Let's start there.
Well, I don't know that the title character. There's enough mystery to the character or to the title that I think we'd like to preserve that.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
I think anybody that's familiar with Ibsen's play would be able to draw some conclusions, but we'd rather not go too into it.
Yeah,
sure. Well, we need to have a little bit of a synopsis here, or I'll just have to say goodbye and we'll go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Well, we will say that. Actually, Joe, you have like a 10-second Trinity description of the show, right?
I just say that the focus of the play, I would say, is on a trinity of relationships between husband and wife and the husband's sister. The husband and the wife are mother and father to their son, whose name is Eric.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Mark Jackson has said he's attracted to Ibsen and his flawed characters and their struggles, which I guess finds in the theater a great stage to work out both the external and the internal aspects of their personalities. Now, what are your flaws? Give me your flaws and your characters.
You know, I feel like I should start on this one because...
Marilee talking.
Yes, hi. So I play Joey, and you know... I think externally, when people look at her, they would say that she is extremely flawed, self-involved, very sort of one-sided, could be considered very unlikable, and is very much a career woman, very driven, and yet very, very, very honest about things. And I think that's one of her saving graces, is that she is extremely direct and honest. And I think the great challenge and great joy of playing this character is, how do you play a character who's not a hero and yet bring a great deal of humanity to that character, so that people, they may not like her, but they understand and they will go on her journey. So, yeah.
How about you, Joe?
Yeah, and I think a scenario that I don't think I'm giving too much away that happens actually before the play sort of explains my character's flaws is, I play the character of Freddie, and before the play starts, he goes on a six-month sojourn in the European wilderness to process some emotions and to finish a book on human responsibility. He leaves his family and his son behind to write a book on what responsibility is.
Wow.
So
okay.
I think that's pretty – that says everything.
Touch of irony there going on. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Tell us about your other castmates.
Other castmates. So we got myself, Freddie,
and Joey. Yeah, and we're married, by the way.
Yeah, we're husband and wife, mother and father.
Yes.
And I have my sister, whose name is Andy, played by Mariah Castle. Jack Whitmire plays our son, Eric.
He's so good in this show.
Yeah.
He's so good.
He's amazing. And Wilma plays a mysterious character that goes by the name of Rat Wife.
Which is actually an original. I mean, that character was named Rat Wife in Ibsen's Little Eye Elf. Mm-hmm. So that is a direct. That's actually the only character that's named the same in Mark's translation, Mark's adaptation, actually. Mm. So yeah, she's kind of a fairly magical, strange character in the show. And then there's Bernie, who is the architect of this house that we've built out in the woods, and that's where actually the show takes place, is this lovely, gorgeous, wooded retreat that
probably somewhere in the Marin Headlands, looking out over San Francisco.
Yes, yeah. And he's the architect, and we find that he might have a little fancy for Freddie's sister. So there's a little something there.
That sounds okay.
Yeah.
I mentioned in the early introduction, Marilee, that you're a veteran of Mark Jackson's writing.
Yes.
Having been in Salamania. Do you see similar characteristics in his writing in this work? Or was Salamania also a adaptation of someone else's work?
No, Salamania was an original piece. You know what I see similarities in is that Mark does not shy away from pushing the audience out of their comfort zone. That's the similarity I see. He is he's a provocateur, and his work challenges especially American audiences, especially Bay Area audiences, challenges audiences' expectation of what is accessible theater. You know, sometimes his work is very polarizing. People can see his work and say, "My God, that is the most innovative, amazing thing I've ever seen." And other people will say, I don't understand. So this is one of those pieces that kind of walks that line where there's real human relationships, very deep, very riveting, actually, human relationships. And there's also a stylized aspect to the way that he's directed it that, you know, pushes our sensibilities of what we think a drama should look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious about the whole directing process and Mark's approach. Perhaps you can both address this. How much direction is he giving you? Is it a lot of his interpretation, or is he basically letting you guys run the show?
Joe?
Well, I've worked on at least two other productions with Mark. This is the first time working on something with him that he's written. And I find that Mark is extremely trusting of other artists, and he actually relies a great deal on what actors bring to the table. Often he's even, you know, devising with them in pieces. Yet I think he has a very clear vision of what the piece is to be. And he expects us all to, you know, adhere to that. So there's nothing, I would say, sort of autocratic or about what he's doing. But yeah, he's incredibly articulate. He has a clear vision, and those are two great things that you want from any good director.
Can you give me an example of something you might have done one way, and then he's made you change your opinion of the way a character was either developing or just the way you delivered a line?
I feel like I could name a whole bunch. There's one monologue that I have where in the audition I used this monologue to seduce my husband, and I did it in almost a very sexual way. And I thought I was doing great at doing that. You know, I really felt I nailed it. And then when we got into the room, he actually completely went 180 on me and said, it's actually not a seduction. You're actually just opening up your heart in a very different way. This is not coming from base sexuality. This is coming from a heart space. And and we're still refining that. Literally, you know, we're doing runs right now, dress rehearsals right now, and I'm getting little notes about just this one line, you still came off just a little bit too hard. Can you soften this one word?
Wow, okay.
So it can get very precise
that
way.
He's listening.
Oh, yeah, no, he's listening, yeah.
How about you, Joe?
Yeah, I don't know. That was just making me think of how incredibly sharp and focused he is, and totally goofy, too. Like, he gets really silly. Like, I got an injury in one of our shows, and he named my injury that I still have Hank. So I walk around with Hank the rest of my life. I have Hank in my back. And lately, he's attached himself, a miniature-sized portion of himself, to my beard. And that little Mark Jackson on my beard communicates to me constantly. But he gets to be – I appreciate his bluntness. He can be really blunt with me. And, like, sometimes he'll catch me sort of, like, talking, like, a little too, you know, naturalistic. And I'm almost – he catches me trying to be, like, Brando or something, you know.
Stop
and I'll just stop. Stop doing that. We're not
– you know, so I appreciate that. Reset the scene.
Exactly.
He does have a fondness, too, for restraint. That's a big word for him, is restraint. Like, you're not going to see a lot of over-emoting in his pieces. He wants – I feel like, in general – actors, we desire to have a lot of emotion and to be expressing a lot of emotion. And he'll say, that's all great. Now restrain it. You know, put a cap on it so we're not seeing all the goo out there.
Keep it to yourself.
Keep it to yourself.
Yeah, because I think, you know, it goes into the territory of sort of, you know, self-indulgence a little bit. And I think he does a good job of keeping us from that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's Merrily Talkington with Joe Estlack there in the Aurora Theater Company's presentation of the world premiere of Little Eric, directed and written by Mark Jacobson and
Jackson.
Mark Jackson, based on Henrik Ibsen's, or at least using Henrik Ibsen's Little Eyolf.
Eyolf
as a jumping point. Merrily, please correct my terminology if I'm incorrect. Would you, as one of only a couple of legally blind actors to earn an MFA in acting, consider yourself disabled or differently abled? How are you? Do you need to put a label on yourself?
Yeah, thank you for asking, one, because the terminology constantly changes. So sometimes I will say I'm an actor with a disability. I rarely say I am disabled. It seems like such a huge identifier, but it's kind of like, hi, I'm Merrily, I have red hair. Hi, I'm Merrily, I have a disability. So it's just one of the things that I have. Although the language these days is otherly abled, differently abled, I don't use that. It doesn't just feel natural in my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, I'll say either I'm legally blind, I have low vision, or I have a disability.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about your vision journey?
I mean. Yeah, sure. I have a progressive degenerative eye disease called cone rod dystrophy. So I've been losing my vision since I was a kid. My mom is blind. And what it basically means is I have zero central vision. I'm totally blind centrally. So when I look straight ahead at something, there's nothing there. Mm. I only have peripheral vision, which is, you know, when you're looking with your side vision.
Sure, sure.
And that is corrected to legal blindness with my glasses on. So, you know, I don't drive. I used enlarged texts. But this is just an interesting thing. I've actually chosen not to wear my glasses on stage, which kind of puts me even in a completely different realm of legal blindness, because it actually makes me listen more.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to do that a lot, actually, on stage, because the more I'm not focusing on what I can't see, the more I can actually be present with the other people on stage.
Interesting, yeah.
So,
yeah. I'm wondering if you're maybe hypersensitive to how you might appear, or that your gestures might becoming exaggerated and not necessarily endemic to the character. Is that...
No.
No?
I never worry about that.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's good. And Joe, you said you've also worked with Mark Jackson. I'm wondering, what were the other productions you worked on with him?
Wojciech and Bonnie.
Which was an amazing show.
Thank you.
Amazing.
An earlier publicist here.
Oh, my God. It was amazing.
That's great.
Another one was Bonnie and Clyde. They were both at Shotgun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what's coming up for either of you? After fraught question. I should tell myself not to ask actors what's coming up next, because it's always a loaded question.
Yeah. I'm actually relocating to New York, and I've been invited to join the team of Ideation with SF Playhouse. They're taking a show there, and I'm acting as ASM and an understudy for that show. That's what's approaching right now.
And for you, Marilee?
Well, I guess this is as good a time as any.
Spill it.
I'm also moving to New York.
I haven't told
anybody. You're the first person I've told.
You're not bucking up. Is that true?
So
yes. No. Did you say hooking up? No. What did you say?
I said, are you bunking up?
No. But I'm also going back to New York after the show closes.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I lived in Brooklyn for 15 years. I'll tell you some hot spots to catch.
Awesome. That's great. Thank you.
That's once again, the Aurora Theater presents the world premiere of Little Eric at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Marilee Tarkington and Joe Estlack here in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your insights into the show, and we'll hope to get some people to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Information at auroratheater.org. That's Aurora, TheatreOrg. That's how it's spelled. And that's an appropriate segue into this next segment here on Open Air.
Miss Peretti, please spell syzygy.
S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. Syzygy?
We have a winner!
Thank you! Thank you! Thank you!
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, my parents keep on telling me, just being here is winning, although I know it isn't so.
But it's a very nice, very, very nice,
very, very, very nice, very nice beginning.
Our winner here last year, Chip Tolentino. Myth Brady. And our youngest competitor, Logan Schwartz and Grubinier.
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Game, I'll stand when they announce my name.
Leaf Coney Bear.
And try and keep from shaking.
Alack, if shaking will not pass.
Cause it's a very big, very fraught, simple, but it's not. It's a very big undertaking.
Returning after last season's tragic setback, William Barfee.
It's pronounced Barfay. There's an accent ado.
I'm not sure who this girl is.
Marcy Park, recent transfer.
Winner's destination, Washington, D.C.
Plasma TV in a fancy hotel, where they treat you well.
Well, did that perhaps introduce a bit of repressed anxiety to listeners? A memory from elementary school, perhaps? Well, that's from the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, the Tony Award-winning musical, which makes its way to the Hill Barn Theater through February 7th. Here to talk about the production are two of the cast members, Samantha Rose Cardenas, who plays Olive Ostrovsky in The Bee, is making her Hill Barn Theater debut in the role of Olive. Recent roles include Ariel in The Little Mermaid, Maria in West Side Story, and Heather Duke in Heathers. Welcome to you, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And Joey McDaniel, who plays William Barfay in this production. Some of his recent roles include Amos in Chicago, Uncle Fester in the Addams Family, as well as Franz and Igor in Young Frankenstein. When not performing in the theater, that's spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E, by the way, Joey is a designer for EA, or Electronic Arts. Welcome, Joey.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, what a fun show. When did you guys first hear about the show? It's kind of off my radar. I heard it back when it was in the Tonys, but now it's coming back to the Bay Area. It's terrific.
I heard about it a couple years ago. There were a couple theaters around the Bay Area that were doing productions of it. Had the opportunity to learn about it as I was auditioning for those productions. And my best friend actually played the role of Olive Ostrovsky in the East Bay a couple years ago. So it's been on my radar for a few years. And so when I heard that Hilborn was doing it, I was very, very excited and gunning for the role of Olive.
Nice. How about you?
When it was doing its run on Broadway, there was a couple of people in that particular cast who I was big fans of already. Celia Keenan Bolger, who is the original Olive, such a big fan of her. She's just amazing in everything she does. So, yeah, had heard of this funny, quirky little show where some of the audience was on stage and just had to find out more about it. And fast forward to Hilborn doing it, it's like, oh yes, I must go do that show.
Well, I'm of an age that I remember spelling bees in elementary school. Did you guys have spelling bees when you were growing up?
Yeah, yeah. Lost on the first word in the first round. I wish I could tell you what word it was, but we went to go support somebody else.
Speaking of repressed memories,
and, oh, first
that
word,
word
first
you're going to like have it like pull out a knife or something. Joey McDaniel playing William Barfay. Tell us about his character, William Barfay.
He's real guarded, and that comes across as sort of prickly and maybe even jerky. But I think he's just a super insular guy who's not had a lot of friends and so has become very self-focused. And part of his lovely journey, slight spoiler, is that he learns to care for somebody else and he's grown to understand that others have emotions.
Okay. That's Joey McDaniel playing William Barfay. Samantha Rose, describe your character, Olive.
Olive, she's very shy. I think that the core of Olive is that she just wants to be loved, and she wants to give love. She comes from a bit of a broken home that becomes very apparent in the beginning of the show, that her parents aren't always around as much as she would like them to be. And she just wants to feel like she's a part of something, and she wants to make friends, and at the same time, it's incredibly difficult for her to do that. So it's that constant tension between what she wants most and what's also most difficult for her to do, to put herself out there like that.
Mm. And now there lies the true torch song of the work as well. Tell us a little bit, I guess you just did, about the song I Love You.
Yeah, the I Love You song, it is one of my most favorite songs in all of the musical theater canon. I just think it is so full of honesty and raw emotion. It is a beautiful trio between Olive and her mom and her dad, which are really actually imaginary versions of her mom and her dad because neither of them are at the Bee supporting her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really amazing to sing, actually, because I don't ever see my parents singing with me.
Hmm.
They're not in my line of vision, and they're behind me, so everything I see is in my imagination. And the setup of the song, I think, is brilliant. It comes with the word chimerical. She's spelling the word chimerical. And it's the song just it shows that Olive is not only incredibly longing for this love from her parents, but also that she's really incredibly intuitive for being so young. She's very in tune and very intelligent, very in tune with the difficulties that her parents are having and how they're affecting her and how maybe it's not about her, but that she's still sad about it.
Let's hear a little bit of that song from the original cast, I Love You. Tell us first, though, why is the music starting off in an Indian sort of sound?
So Olive's mother...
Indian dots, not feathers.
Yeah, Olive's mother is on a 9-month spiritual quest in an ashram in India. So she's imagining that her mom is singing to her in that Indian sort of theme.
I Love You from the original cast recording of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, and then more with cast members Samantha Rose Cardenas and Joey McDaniel.
We always knew you were a winner. We saw it when you smiled. Start from the beginning, when you were a beginner. You were the perfect child. We always knew you were a champion. Your sadness filled my room. Should feel my gloom. Blame it on me. Blame it on your daddily and mammily. 'Cause depression runs in our family. I love you. I love you. I love everything about you, dear.
Wildly fanciful.
That is correct.
Celia Keenan-Bolger from the Broadway production of the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. You can hear Samantha Rose Cardenas and company sing that tune in the Hill Barn Theater's production down at the Hill Barn Theater. That's spelled Hillbarn, T-H-E-A-T-R-E .org for more information. And back now with Samantha Rose and Joey. Boy, that's going to make people cry, I can tell already. And I should mention that the music and the book are by William Finn, the author of the wonderful falsettos, great musical as well. So you've got a great master that is crafting these tunes. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to see on stage and a bit about the pit, who's in the orchestra, or at least what's in the orchestra.
Yeah, sure.
Joey McDaniel.
So there's a great five-piece band in our so-called pit, which is actually on our second floor, led by Rick Reynolds.
What do you call it when it's on the second floor? A raised pit?
The top pit? back the loft? I like loft. Loft is good. And Rick
is... Don't be too expensive if it was loft in this town.
And Rick's absolutely fantastic. He pushes very hard and for all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And because of that, those five pieces sound way bigger than you would expect just five to do, from the amazing cello to the really rocking drums on some of those really fun pandemonium songs. The set looks like a gymnasium, and we are sitting on the bleachers, and we have audience members come and join us. So what you expect to see is a bunch of scared people trying to spell all the words right.
talk about childhood anxieties brought to the stage. I can imagine the sweat pouring from some of these people already.
And we might start off easy, but we are not joking.
That's Joey McDaniel. He and Samantha Rose Cardenas are among the cast members of the Hill Barn Theater's production of the Tony Award-winning musical comedy, the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee at the Hill Barn Theater through February 7th. Information at hillbarntheater.org. Samantha and Joey together spell Hill Barn Theater. Hill Barn Theater.
H-I-L-L-B-A-R-N-T-H-E-A-T-R-E.
Hill Barn Theater.
I'm going to go with a bell for Samantha on that one. Thanks, guys, for coming in. Have a great production. Well, on a different note, Edward Outwater returns to the San Francisco Symphony to lead their current subscription season offering, which has as its theme the exotic East, the magic of Weber, Saint-Saëns, and more, that more being Ferruccio Busoni's Suite from Turandot and Paul Hindemith's Symphonic Metamorphoses of themes by Weber. Stephen Hoff is the guest pianist for the piano concerto. Maestro Outwater is a regular on the podium for the San Francisco Symphony's summer concert offerings, which includes their annual free performance at Stern Grove. With the symphony, he has recorded Nathaniel Stuckey's The Composer is Dead, now one of the most performed works of the 20th century and now coming into the 21st century. I imagine it will continue that streak. And a composer that Outwater worked with for a concert at the new Soundbox space as well. The Santa Monica native served as resident conductor of the symphony from 2001 to 2006, and since then has been seen on stages around the world, including guest stints with the New York and Los Angeles Philharmonics, in Tokyo and New Zealand, and is now in his ninth season as music director of Ontario's Kitchener-Waterloo Symphony, in addition to his ongoing summer duties here in San Francisco. I caught up with him yesterday at Davies Symphony Hall for a brief conversation. Edwin Outwater, welcome back to Open Air.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Ferruccio Busoni is not the first name you think of when you think of Turandot, is it?
It is not. However, I think you're going to really enjoy this music. It's part of the idea of the program that we put together this week was exotic influences of the East. So obviously all the Turandot kind of has that, all the versions of it. And Busoni's is the least known, but it's absolutely delightful and charming music.
I thought at first it would be an arrangement of the Puccini, but it's not at all. It's his original work.
Exactly. And we're doing four parts of it, a lot of marches, some very comic music, and then a little beautiful interlude that for some reason has green sleeves in it. It's very odd music, but it's very wonderful. And Busoni has a way of kind of shifting notes around, changing modalities in a way that's very sly and very clever, very much his own voice.
In spite of this being Busoni's most popular orchestral work, this is the first San Francisco performances that we'll actually hear.
That's right. As a matter of fact, the music off of which the musicians are playing is over 100 years old, that it was bought from the Pittsburgh Symphony Library near the beginning of the history of this orchestra, and it's never been played. It's in surprisingly good shape. And and you know, even though it's 100 years old and not often played, sometimes real gems get left behind, and a lot of orchestras do play this music. It just, we haven't happened to have done it here.
Puccini himself actually attended a play of Turandot, and I'm wondering if maybe he heard a version that had Busoni's music being played in it.
Who knows? And who knows why this is such an obsessive, you know, this play. It's, I guess it's a, kind of this exotic fairy tale that takes place in all sorts of different countries, actually. And even Weber, going back to the very beginning, you know, wrote this Turandot march.
Not to be obsessed with the Puccini, but I guess Nina Stemma, who was a guest of mine on Open Air recently for when she was here for the Beethoven Festival singing Leonore, she's going to be singing the lead for Puccini's Turandot this Saturday for the Mets Live and HD broadcast.
Double Turandot. You can get two fixes in 1 week. And you know, we have this third Turandot march, which is in the second movement of the Hindemith piece. The most famous part of the Hindemith Symphonic Metamorphoses is the scherzo based on Weber's Turandot.
We'll have to play that as we go out today in this interview. Speaking of Turandot, and another composer that's on today's program, Carl Maria von Weber's Overture to Oberon. Weber also wrote in some incidental music for Turandot.
Yeah, if you know me and you know how I program, there are all sorts of little interconnections, and I wouldn't say this program is totally thematic, but having a classic Weber piece, you know, bookend the program with Hindemith's version of Weber at the end of the program was definitely intentional.
Nicely done. Speaking of Weber, he wrote this while he was dying of tuberculosis and was given a choice at this stage of his career to write either on Oberon or Faust, and he chose the Oberon, although it's not the Oberon that we know from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Right. Is it kind of an Egyptian thing? Or, yeah, exactly. Was it Egyptian?
It was a poem that was made.
Right. I'm not an Oberon expert. I know it's not the Shakespeare's Oberon, but it's an exotic fairy tale for sure. And I'm sorry he was so sick when he wrote it, because the music is incredibly happy and cheerful. It's kind of exactly like A Midsummer Night's Dream, Mendelssohn's music, you know, in its character. It's kind of this kind of foresty and dreamy and you know, fairy-like in its delivery.
Well, this very unique program that you've put together also includes the very gifted pianist Stephen Hoff. And he's going to be doing one of the lesser-known piano concertos of Camille Saint-Saëns, the fifth, also known as the Egyptian. I'm acquainted with this.
That's how the program came together, actually, that when I was asked to conduct this concert, the one thing on the program was the Saint-Saëns' fifth piano concerto. And it was a piece I'd never conducted before. I tend to like the music of Saint-Saëns very much, so I was delighted to do it, really excited to work with Stephen, with whom I've never worked, and I kind of went with that theme of this, you know, Europeans exploring the East and exotic. And rather than having a contrast, I kind of doubled down, because the Hindemith has this kind of Eastern influence, as obviously does the Busoni piece. So it's a running theme throughout the concert. And it's interesting to hear how three different composers kind of treat these exotic sounds. You could have, of course, included Debussy and Ravel and lots of other people, but this is kind of how it turned out.
And then, as you mentioned, rounding the whole program out with the Hindemith Symphonic Metamorphoses.
Right. That piece is, if you know the history of this orchestra, Maestro Blumstedt's recording of this piece is one of the great recordings of the San Francisco Symphony. And I learned when I was asking around that they haven't performed this piece here at Davies in over 20 years. And it was high time to do it again. And I will say that, you know, over the last year as I've been coming to conduct other things, the players from the orchestra are so excited. They were telling me how excited they were to be doing this piece again. And in these rehearsals, I have to say it sounds spectacular. So there's a great desire and sense of fun in revisiting this piece. It's been far too long.
As a flutist, I love the flute part of that Symphonic Metamorphosis. It's just a wonderful work.
A famous audition piece, Obbligato flute solo at the end of the third movement, which is played beautifully by Tim Day.
Well, on a different front, tell me about this Hack the Orchestra project of yours.
Well, it's a project I'm doing up in Kitchener-Waterloo, which is my orchestra in Canada. If you don't know the area, it is a huge high-tech incubator. The University of Waterloo is kind of like the MIT of Canada. And there are, like Silicon Valley, a tremendous amount of startups that are happening there. And it was a way to connect the orchestra. You know, you can hack things other than code. You can hack devices. You can hack ideas. It's kind of a culture. And so we thought we would create a situation in which people who had no experience with the orchestra would come to a concert and kind of hack the orchestral experience, like what a concert is like, and create something in 48 hours that they could share. And, you know, we had a contest of which was best. And it was really, really wonderful. They got to come to a concert, and then they had 2.5 hours to ask the orchestra questions. And our orchestra was absolutely game. And I think it was over 100 people just staying up all night. And we first place winner was a group of kids, I think, in just early university who created an algorithm that makes a fractal image, unique fractal image of the music being played. So you could come home with a kind of a unique image of the music you just heard as you walk out the door.
This sounds like it's a project that's going to be continuing.
It is, and we still use it. On our website, there's a kind of a concierge site called How Do I Symphony that was one of the Hack the Orchestra winners. And they can it asks the potential audience member questions and then very wittily kind of takes them through this fun process, keeps their attention, and recommends concerts.
Well, while we're on the Kitchener-Waterloo, what's next for that group and this coming season? This is certainly a nice time of year for you to revisit San Francisco as opposed to Ontario.
Yeah, we're in the deep midwinter. I would say next week I'm going back and I'm working with an amazing artist, a throat singer named Tanya Tagak, who won the big Polaris Prize, is becoming rapidly very famous internationally. He's also with San Francisco's own Kronos Quartet as well. And we're doing a throat singing meets orchestra concert. We have a wonderful thing coming up. Some new commissions, concerto for orchestra, lots of fun things are up ahead. Oh, and a concert about geometry and music. We do a lot of concerts about science and music. And we did one about neuroscience and one about physics, and this is about geometry coming up.
So perhaps these will have legs for your tenure as the summer music director here in San Francisco.
There hasn't been any direct crossover with those concerts yet, the Indianapolis Symphony actually picked up one of my concerts, the one about physics, and we were able to put it on. So and we've toured the physics concert also to the National Arts Center. So they actually have had legs, which is wonderful for a little orchestra like ours to, you know, do these unique programs and I would say truly innovative programs that are now going elsewhere.
Well, a couple of your recent appearances here in San Francisco I missed, unfortunately, at the new Soundbox space. You were here with Nathaniel Stuckey, which must have been wonderful. And then back, you were invited for December with the wonderful Meow Meow, who I heard at Berkeley Rep a while back. Tell us about both of these concerts.
Well, I'm very, very grateful for MTT and the Symphony to entrust me with this Soundbox. In fact, I opened the Soundbox season with Meow this year. And for me, everyone has a different take on what to do with it. My concerts are kind of narrative. They kind of amp up, you know, the first one was about California music, and it started with kind of nice, kind of organic Terry Riley music and kind of explored San Francisco-y things and ended up in kind of an acid trip 1960s place. And for Meow Meow, we were examining cabaret, but what it was and what it became. So we started with Schubert Art Song, went through the usual Brecht and Weill stuff, and then ended with Ligeti, Mysteries of the Macabre, and a torch song by Laurie Anderson. And what's great about Soundbox is it's a dream for me because you have a lighting guy, you have a beautiful visual designer, you have these wonderful resources of that space, and what they encourage you to do is create a kind of, you know, a few hours of pure imagination, and I've always loved that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to go to Laurie Anderson concerts, and all the video and the, just how it all kind of seamlessly held together with great music was really, really influential on me. And now the fact that I'm able to do this is fantastic.
So I take it that means we're going to be hearing more from you and Soundbox.
I have a feeling, yes. Well, I don't know if it's official, but sure.
Well, I mentioned the summer programs that you do on a regular basis with the San Francisco Symphony. That includes the wonderful Stern Grove concerts, the free Stern Grove concerts. We'll do a preview some other time about this coming summer, but I imagine things are already well underway for this summer planning.
Yeah, and I can't give away anything because it hasn't been released. But, you know, a lot of the people who come in the summer, we have found that are coming for the first time. And not just the people who come to the concerts in the park, bring their kids, but also the people who come to hear our concerts in Davies. And so for me, it's a big responsibility on the classical programs, especially that we give them a really exciting experience. So often there's a hook, like a very famous piece of Beethoven 5 or something. But then once they're in the door, we often go beyond that and take them down a slightly different journey, which is kind of my thing. And it's been very successful, great houses, great response. And it's a fun, though very busy time in the summer, you know, reaching all these people. And this is, I guess, my third season officially doing this as director of summer concerts. And it's a lot of puzzle pieces. It's a lot of work. But what's really gratifying is you can reach people that have never been to the symphony. And sometimes it's Beethoven, but I've been able to sneak in David Lang and Bryce Dessner and Sarah Kirkland Snyder and a lot of contemporary music, especially in the free concerts, to kind of give people the idea of the breadth of what we do.
Well, it's always a pleasure to see you on the podium, not only for this concerts, but for the summer season ahead. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Jackie, I understand the folks in Durham, North Carolina at your church helped arrange the funds for you to come here.
Yeah, they did, which was really nice of them. It's a great place. It's a Lutheran church.
Little extra bonus interview from the past there on Open Air. That was, just prior to that, Edwin Outwater, who leads the San Francisco Symphony this afternoon, tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday at Davies Symphony Hall. Details at sfsymphony.org. On the program, Weber's Overture to Oberon, the fifth piano concerto of Camille Saint-Saëns with guest pianist Stephen Hoff, Busoni's Excerpts from Turandot, and the Symphonic Metamorphoses of Paul Hindemith. Here's a taste of that aforementioned wonderful recording of the Hindemith under its conductor laureate, Herbert Blomstedt. The unmistakable sound of Paul Hindemith, his symphonic metamorphoses on themes of Weber. Heard for the first time in 20 years or so at the San Francisco Symphony this weekend under the direction of Maestro Edwin Outwater. In fact, getting underway in just a few minutes if you want to dash down to Davie Symphony Halls for today's matinee. More Hindemith this Sunday, by the way, for Old First Concerts as the Ives Collective presents a program called The End of Time, which includes Paul Hindemith's quartet and Messiaen's quartet for the end of time. Information at oldfirstconcerts.org, that is. The San Francisco Early Music Society concerts continue this weekend as well with the very first Viennese School and the ensemble Quicksilver presenting music from pre-Mozartian Vienna. That's Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday here in San Francisco. Information at sfems.org. My thanks to Kevin Vance, who subbed for me last week as host of Open Air, and as always to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. A reminder that you can see here, rather, archived shows, offer suggestions for segments at our website, klw.org. Look for the Open Air pull down. Next week, you'll hear about the African American Shakespeare Company's production of The Colored Museum by George C. Wolfe. and the Cutting Balls production of playwright Catherine Sherman's new play, Ondine, which retells the Little Mermaid and Pelias and Melisande myths as a heartbreaking, haunting, and hypnotic transformational first love story. That's next week on Open Air. I'm David Latulli. Do join me if you can, or listen after the fact, as you can to today's show at our website, kalw.org.
From clavichord to shortwave radios and everything in between. Hear what's new in the world of experimental music this Friday on Music from Other Minds at 11 p.m.
Music from Other Minds right after LA Theater Works on Friday evenings here on KALW San Francisco, where an hour of news from the BBC in London is next. This is your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco, online at kalw.org. It's 2 o'clock.